everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, best-selling author, award-winning public speaker, and facilitator of global workplace culture change. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get people managers from around the world to share actionable things that you can do too to create a great place to work. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Culture Makers podcast with me, Colin Ellis, and I am delighted to be joined today by Katie Kelly. Now, Katie is one of a kind. When I was writing her bio, I'm like, wow. She's a two-time Paralympian and she won gold in the triathlon in Rio, which I'm keen to hear about. She's a double world champion and she was also awarded the Order of Australia in 2017. She is a passionate social welfare advocate, is the Disability Experience Manager for MEGT in Australia, and is also the founder and director of Sport Access, whose mission is to help Aussie kids with a disability to play and participate in sport. And she joins me now from Queensland, I think, Katie. You're up in Queensland, didn't you?
Hello, Colin. Yeah. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, fabulous. Let's get straight into it. Winning gold, that must have been something else. Whenever I speak to athletes and the goal is to win gold, they pour everything into it. I imagine the same was for you, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I came to appreciate that gold medal when I went to the Tokyo Paralympics, and I came sixth at that. And one of my team members just got pipped at the finish line to get a silver. And so I appreciated winning gold. It just requires everything to go right. And, you know, I know you talk a lot about mindset, and it's more about obviously the physical output, but the capacity to be in it and to be on that day is huge. And when I reflect on Rio Paralympics, Colin, I'll never forget lining up at that start line on a floating platoon in Copacabana Beach with Jesus the Redeemer in the background, surrounded by nine of the other world's greatest vision-impaired paratriathletes, female, and looking around me were Spanish, were the Great Brits, were the Irish, were the Americans. And I just had this sense of like how good is this? Here we are, this group of women that have overcome enormous adversity with vision loss or are blind, and we're doing the sport of triathlon and we are competing at the Paralympics. And that's where my mind was just before the gun went off. And then my guide, McKeely Jones, who won the silver medal at Sydney Olympics, very much got me back into reality. She's like, okay. But yeah, it was just extraordinary on every level to represent Australia, to be part of the very first paratriathlon race. It debuted at Rio Paralympics, to be amongst those women, to have my friends and family in the background. And I'll never forget that moment I crossed the banner and held that finishing line banner in my hand and feeling the texture and just saying to myself, this is the moment.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just listening to that story. Absolutely. Yeah. Just absolutely amazing. And, you know, you mentioned mindset, and it's one thing to do the training. It's one thing to listen to the coach, but it's a whole other thing to actually show up on the day, Katie, right? And, and you know, often we'll hear athletes saying, it's about being in the zone. And partly, of course, that's physical preparation, but of course it's mental preparation too, right? And getting in that right mindset.
Yeah, and I mean, for every athlete is different. I'm quite a spiritual being, and so I do a meditation. And I got up early that morning, like I did most mornings, in the hotel we were staying at Ipanema Beach, and I did a meditation at about 6 a.m. that morning. So I sort of stuck to my same routine. But I remember other athletes a few days out saying, I just can't wait for race day. And whereas I was very much like, I don't want it to rush any more than it needs to. So whereas Tokyo was very different. Tokyo, I was 47. Obviously, the pandemic had delayed it for a year. My body was tired. I was aching. I just kind of, for me, it was about getting the job done. And, you know, I reflect on my mindset for Tokyo. It was completely different to Rio. Rio, I was in it and I was on. But I think it's also that, for me, it's a real sense of gratitude and privilege. And, you know, I think I'm not a talented athlete, but I guess the way I prepared for Rio and Tokyo was a lot of grit, determination, showing up and consistency in the way I trained, and particularly the way I trained and showed up for my coach and also my guide that I competed with.
You talked there about talent. You know, it's one of the points that I make, you know, as someone who left school with zero qualifications, is someone said, oh, well, you know, where did you acquire the talent? I was just like, I'm not sure I ever acquired the talent. I just decided to work really hard at what I did, you know, and I had this relentless desire to get better.
Yeah.
You know, whatever job that I was in, I just wanted to get better at that job and be good at that. And I think sometimes what that does is, regardless of age, as someone who's on the wrong side of 50 now, is when you do feel that tiredness, when you do feel that sense of lethargy, it's the thing that kind of is front and center in my mind, is just do one thing, then do another, just do one thing, then do another, to create that sense of momentum. And was that very much the case leading into the games, with everything that you had to think about, everything that you had to do? Was it about maintaining momentum?
Oh, absolutely. Maintaining momentum and just routine every day and every week was almost the same. And so it's a real fine balance, don't you think, with high performance and achievement, is the balance between balancing lifestyle, right, and balancing your goals. So in some ways, Tokyo became too much all in that I don't feel like I had enough balance in my social life and my other career developments and so on. I just was all in on Tokyo, and all my decisions were based on, will this affect my training? And will it compromise my ability to back up and train as I did? And so I think I lost a little bit of the joy. Yeah. Whereas Rio, but also Rio was the first one and the first experience, and everything was a first. But I think about what you said in terms of when we get fatigue, and certainly after Tokyo, I knew the dip would come. 7 years of a high-performance career, to find my, I guess, my place, my purpose in a career beyond para triathlon, beyond Paralympics. And it was really great. I literally took a year off just to allow myself ultimately to be lazy, because I just felt like I didn't need to set goals and to be achieving anything. We can't be like that all the time, of course. And I was lucky enough that I could go, I did the Camino, the pilgrimage across Spain. And that was perfect for someone who, the only time I'd been overseas in the last 3 years in Spain and Japan was to train or race. And here I was walking with a backpack for 33 days, for 733 kilometres. But then after that, and early 2022, 23, I was able then to kind of go, okay, where do I see my purpose and place and meaning going forward, which for me is very much the advocating of disability and inclusion in community work and play.
Yeah, and I want to talk a fair bit about that, Katie, but I just want to pick up on something. I love the fact that your version of being lazy is to do the Camino. I'm just going to be lazy. I'm just going to trek for 733 kilometres. Yeah, that's, you know, for some it's watching Netflix, for some it's doing the Camino. High performance is really interesting. It's something I get asked a lot about. In fact, when I start working with organisations, like, oh, we want a really high performance culture. You know, we want everyone to be working 110%. I'm like, yeah, so that's not high performance culture. In fact, that's burnout. High performance occurs when people are happy, and that requires a good balance. It's like some of the highest performing cultures that I work with work 9 to 5. And this concept is almost, it's strange to people. It's like they make equal amounts of time for rest and play, but when they play, they're all in. They're 100% in, and they recognize that actually what 100% in means is working 80%, because you still need 20% to take breaks through the day, but that the 5% outside your comfort zone is where we grow. It's that thing that feels just a little bit challenged, you know. And for some, it's when you go to the gym and it's just that last set of reps that you have to do. It's the last kilometer, and you'll know this as a triathlete. It's the last thing, and that's where it becomes that mindset thing. And I think high performance really for me stems from happiness, which you kind of echoed there with your Tokyo example.
Yeah, and I did a speaking engagement on the weekend at a coaching conference for developing athletes, and we talked about developing our athletes to be resilient, to be, you know, mentally safe and sound, and to express gratitude and have joy in what they are doing, because that is where the performance will come, right? And certainly high performance, it has to be about that balance, because, yes, you will have burnout. And I did have burnout after Tokyo. When you look at my finish line at Tokyo, I literally crawled across that finish line. So it is that really important balance of and quality in what we're doing. And it doesn't mean doing any extra. It's doing it well, what you do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really great. What a great point that is. It's about doing what you do well rather than always having to think about and do that extra. So let's talk about, by the way, if anyone listening, if you haven't heard Katie speak, or if you're looking for a great speaker, look no further. And we'll share Katie's details on the podcast for those who are interested in hearing Katie talk. So tell me a little bit about the background then, Katie. How did we get to Gold? How did you become this advocate for disability awareness? We'll talk about some of your work shortly, but what did that pathway look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really starts at the age of 5 years old. They picked up that I had a profound hearing loss, right? And so I started wearing hearing aids from that age. I was born in a country town, one of five, and back in the 80s, they didn't have the hearing test like they do today. So you can imagine, Colin, somebody asked me this recently, what do you think is the most important thing for people with a disability in our community? And it's communication. It's the ability to connect and engage. And so as a 5-6 year old, I really didn't hear much for the first 5 or 6 years of my life and was quite delayed in my speech development and speech comprehension. So I had a lot of speech therapy, and I had a wonderful education and support around me. And so on I went to university, and then in my early 20s, my eyesight wasn't quite right. I was struggling at the pub at night with my mates at the at uni, and we all thought I'd had one too many drinks because I kept tripping over, but we weren't quite sure the cause. And eventually I saw an ophthalmologist, and I was confirmed that I had a condition called Usher syndrome. Mm-hmm. It's a deafblind condition, and it results in gradual loss of both hearing and eyesight. So there I was as a 21-year-old in my dream job. I just landed a job in a rugby league role in marketing comms, to be told that I had this degenerative condition. We don't know how long or how much your hearing and eyesight will deteriorate. And you know what came to my mind? I'm equipped in that I have education, I have a career underway, I'm very active, I love my sport, but is the world around me equipped? And that is the world around me equipped and inclusive, that someone like myself with profound hearing loss and who's going to gradually lose their eyesight can still achieve the same goals that you, Colin Ellis, would have set for yourself as a 21-year-old. So in many ways, my advocacy for inclusion really started from a very young age and of experiencing it and knowing what the barriers are that prevent people who have additional challenges to participate, right? And then I'll just go fast forward to the age of 39, and I was doing lots of triathlons, and I did the Norway Midnight Sun Marathon and New York Marathon and Ironmans. And it was through one phone call to Triathlon Australia, and I wanted to do the Hawaii Ironman. And they said, Katie, we're actually looking for vision impaired athletes to compete at Rio. So 18 months after that phone call, Colin, there I was at the Rio Paralympics. So that's just the short of it. I guess my passion for the disability and inclusion space, and obviously being a dual Paralympian, just a wonderful honour, but it's certainly given me a great opportunity to leverage that more, that message of inclusion. Yeah.
Yeah, I spoke at a conference in North America a while back, and the speaker after me was called Dr. Yvette Pegg. She suffered an accident. She was in a wheelchair, but she water skied. She went horseback riding. She skateboarded, and she said the problem's not mine. The problem is the world's, because they immediately see me in a chair and think that I'm not able to do these things.
Yes,
she's like, and, you know, I find myself educating people all the time that I can totally do these things.
And unfortunately, she like I would experience ableism every day and disabled attitude. So I was at Sydney Airport yesterday, flying back to Brisbane. I got off the plane and I'm with my guide dog, Guffrey, and a lady came up and said to me, what are you doing in Brisbane today? And I said, oh, I'm here for work. And she said, oh, do you work, do you? And I said, yes, I do. And so it is this mindset perceptions we still need to change that people have of people with disability. And I guess in many ways, like the lady you just spoke about, there's a part of me that wants to continually do things like the Camino, or I'm thinking about doing a long course triathlon again, because I refuse to let people think, well, you're losing your eyesight. You know, I've got very little vision now. My hearing's quite profound. I'll probably get cochlear soon. But I refuse to buy into that narrative that because of that, my participation in the things that we all love to do will be diminished or reduced. Mm. And I guess you do it because it keeps people accountable that, yes, a person with no vision can still do triathlon. A person in a wheelchair can still go water skiing and do all those things.
Yeah, exactly right. So let's talk a little bit about this in the workplace. I've just finished writing a new book around toxic cultures, and a couple of the examples were ableism showed its face in the sense, I'm trying to remember the exact examples now, where people with disabilities have been mocked. Also, where organisations hadn't taken into consideration when they were redesigning their buildings, things like ramps, things like elevators, things like braille on signs, those kinds of things. So tell me a little bit, Katie, kind of your experience. Where are we in our workplaces, in our cultures? You know, what do people need to think more about? I also want to acknowledge we're a little bit further on than we were. It's still not as fast as certainly as I would like it and the things that I've read. But let's hear what your view on it.
Yeah, and I would like to commend everybody, people that are listening to this podcast, right? Because and the people that I work with and that I share my story to are so open to learning, and the human race, we're always evolving, right? And the other thing is, like in Australia, disability is 1 in 5. By the time we're 55, I think half or 65, half of us would have experienced some form of disability. 1 in 9 of us are carers. So I say disability is in all of us. So, and inclusion benefits everyone. So you think about something like closed captions, the way that movies are projected on screen, not everyone can hear the verbal language, and everyone benefits from closed caption. But in the workplace, I think start with how do people get to work, and how is, and that's where so many people like me said thank you to, unfortunately, we had COVID and the pandemic, but thank you to the evolution of the way we work and that we can dial in and work from home. It makes it more accessible, right? Getting to work can be a challenge. And for someone like me, we know all those rideshare companies out there, and they are trying to do the best that they can. And I won't name them specifically, but I still get refused by rideshare drivers because I have a guide dog. And even though it's legislation and it's against the Disability Discrimination Act, they hide behind this, we're a pet Uber or we're a pet whatever sort of car, we don't have to take you. So, and that's even before I've got in the front door at work, right? So when you're thinking about the experience of a person with disability in your workplace, think about what it is like before, you know, actually getting to work can be a challenge. But I think in the workplace, it's people are fearful of offending and saying the wrong thing. But I always say, just ask the question if you're not sure. Have that conversation with the person. And my day job is with a company called MEGT. We're an apprenticeship service provider, and we've just implemented our Disability Inclusion Action Plan. And I'm really proud of it because it is about actions. It's not tokenistic. It's about real action to create more meaningful employment, to challenge our systems and processes, our IT systems, are they accessible? To look at our buildings and our online environments, are they accessible? How can we improve accessibility in that regard? And one example I will give you, we recently employed someone with no sight. And I can tell you that there were a few people that were very concerned, how are we going to be able to ensure that this person can use all our systems when they're built for a sighted person? And it's such a wonderful conversation to have, because then they understood what ableism was, prioritising needs of people without disability over those people with disability, right? So in that regard, we had to really look at our IT systems, and we implemented the low vision software called JAWS. And I encourage organisations to start thinking about getting this system into your workplace, because you have a whole new market of people there that could come and work for you that are low vision or blind. So I've probably just gone off track there, but there's just an example where it really challenged people's mindset. How are we going to make this work? But it was looking at practical steps that we could take, making mistakes as we went along, but importantly, continual conversations with that person on their experience and what support they needed from us to be better.
Yeah, I remember one of the things that really stuck me when I listened to a vet talk, she said, I want empathy, not sympathy. I don't want you to feel sorry for me. I want you to listen to me, you know?
And that, I mean, when people say things and they're trying to create a connection and they sort of give you this sympathy, I can't imagine what it would like to be lose my sight. I mean, that's a disablest attitude, and it's not helpful. Yeah. And it's also coming from this seat of also their fear that if I had no sight, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. And I say, well, why don't you question the things that a non-sighted person doesn't have access to, and try and improve that in your everyday. The other thing with the way we work, I guess a big part of it is about disclosure and people feeling comfortable to be themselves. And we need more of our leaders to be the role models and visible and talking about the support that they might need. And people don't need to use the word disability, but as I said, we're an aging population. Disability is close to all of us. So we've encouraged this conversation through virtual coffee catch-up with myself and other people with disability in our workplace to create an environment where people can share experiences. And then before they know it, they've just learned that the senior executive of the finance team has, a child with neurodivergent or this other person has a partner that they're caring for that had a road accident. And all of that just helped create, don't you think, a much more humane environment. And everyone is sort of more open-minded to wanting to bring everybody along to the workplace and to be included.
I completely agree. You know, every time I run a culture workshop with a team, cases of how big the group is, that I always start the first maybe 30, 45 minutes with tell the person next to you something that they don't know about you. And there was a guy, and he was one of the senior managers who had a disabled son, and nobody knew. And I was speaking to a guy later on. It was like, I just had no idea of what he had to deal with, what he had to think about day in, day out. And he was like, he's the most professional person that I knew. I was like, but does it give you a different level of empathy towards him? He's like, yeah. I was like, but crucially, do you know a little bit more about something that you didn't know beforehand? And I think there's so much power in those stories that we share. And I don't think we're encouraged to share them, not in the workplace anyway, Katie, unless you do a training course or an offsite like the ones that I do,
So we started doing like an internal podcast series, and I've sort of been the host of that, and I've had different people across the business talk about how we're going to implement our disability inclusion action plan. So whether that's around recruitment, so I'm talking to HR people, procurement, so I'm talking to the procurement manager, because we want 3% of our suppliers to be disability inclusive. I'm talking to our youth coach, who helps young people long-term unemployed that have disability get into jobs. And all of them have very close connection to disability. So it's not only just talking about how are they going to implement our actions out of the disability inclusion action plan, but then they end up sharing their own personal experiences. And, it's so close to all of us. And it comes back to that whole thing of once we make modifications or make changes in the way we work, or we're a bit more flexible or agile as we go through different life stages of being a young parent or being a carer, it benefits everyone. And it creates this really great, strong culture of, I feel like I'm going to be supported. And when I hit those challenging times, which we all do in our life stages, I'm not going to get left behind. So you remove that fear as well.
That's fantastic.
And that fear in the past, I think, has certainly created that toxic culture, because people are fearful. If they're fearful, then they'll behave in a way that probably isn't really, it contravenes their values, but they're doing it in a way to protect themselves. So if you're creating an inclusive culture, people feel supported, then the relationships are more meaningful and trustworthy, and people are, making decisions for the right reasons.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's for me, that's a fabulous initiative, is to share those stories and create a meaningful action plan rather than picking, and these are my words, I feel like organizations, particularly for diversity and inclusion, they often just tick the box, right? There's an awareness tick, whereas I feel there's so much power when you share those stories. So that's great. So this is all of the stuff you're doing for adults, which is fabulous. But then there's the stuff that you're doing for kids as well. So tell me a little bit about the Sports Access Foundation.
That is my passion. So Sport Access Foundation set up after Rio. And I guess the telling point for me, Colin, was coming back from Rio with the incredible success of winning the gold medal. And, my eyesight challenging, it continually evolves. I like to use the word evolve rather than lose, because evolving is like takes me on this growth and this different journey. But my brother said to me, Katie, there's a young girl that's been following your journey, and she, through circumstances, was blind at the age of 8 and had lost her sight quite quickly. So I went and visited her, and, I never forget walking into that room. It was quite dark, and this young girl who was quite small and this beautiful, softly spoken voice. And the first thing she asked me was, Katie, what's it like to compete with a guide? And then she asked me, what sort of tether do you use for the swim and the run? And I was just holding back tears, because, of course, it came back to me that the impact of being a role model and creating visibility, and that's the impact of the Paralympics. Mm. And I'm so privileged that I've had this hugely enormous opportunity to represent Australia like I have, but it certainly drilled home very quickly. And I was already sort of thinking about that, but how can I ensure our next generation have better access to sport, better support, so they can play with their mates? Because children with disability are less than a third likely to play sports than those without. And as you know, sport's expensive, and you've got to get the right culture in the sport and the right support for a child who might be neurodivergent or have mobility access issues. So we give out grants every year, over $30,000 over the last 7 years. It reached out for about 200 kids, and they're from all over Australia. And, you know, it's just beautiful hearing their stories. And three of our recipients have gone on to represent Australia at the Tokyo Paralympics. So it's been just a really great project to be involved in. And you can check us out at sportaccessfoundation.org.au.
Yeah, and I recommend everybody does. I spent about 20 minutes going through the honour roll.
Oh, isn't that
Katie,
cool?
And seeing all these wonderful kids and all of the sports that they're doing. And if there was ever a thing to lift your heart and fill you full of, I don't know, joy, it's seeing what these kids have been able to do through the grants that Sport Access Foundation provides, which is just fabulous.
And, sincerely, thank you for taking the time to do that, because I think once you go in there and you see that, and it brings home just how many children in our community just need that extra support, and you give that to them, it means more than, it's more than the money. It's about us saying to them, we value you, we appreciate your aspirations, and you've said to us that you want to play basketball with your mates, but you need a modified wheelchair, and it takes 100 kilometres to get there because wheelchair basketball is not available in every suburb across Australia. Mm. And it's saying that you matter, and we appreciate there are extra barriers for your participation. And, of course, as we know, once a child feels like they belong and are part of a team, you know, it's a big step forward in ensuring they're on the right pathway in their lives, and certainly getting ahead with their education.
Yes, fabulous. Everyone go and check it out. I've got two more questions for you, and then we'll let you go, Katie. The first one is about culture in sport, which you mentioned. My sense, and of course, you know, there's more demand for the things that I talk about from sports organisations, which signals a change, I think. How has culture in sport changed, you know, in the time that you've been competing, and how does it need to continue to evolve, using that word, you know, to be truly representative of all, would you say?
I think the shift, we're talking about high performance, you know, and it's winning at all costs. And I don't think that's the right mindset to have, winning at all costs. It's around that creating a culture that is inclusive, where people regularly express gratitude, where there is a commitment and a consistency in terms of what are our values and how are we going to deliver on that. And so, you know, we all talked about the Matildas, right? And my observation from the outside was there would have been many different things going on. In any team dynamic, there always is. But consistently, the way that team showed up for their stakeholders, for the media, for the fans, it kept coming back to what their values were, and that they wanted to perform and leave a legacy for Australia. And they did that. And I think when teams can work together and put aside their differences, because they are there, and put aside their frustrations with an injury or not getting selected, but cohesively, you can still have that, you know, common goal and, you know, agreed value set will drive a team's performance. And so I think about too, with my guide that I competed with, you know, we're tethered together in the swim, we do a tandem bike together, and we run together. So that guide partnership and communication is everything. And very much it was around for us that showing up every day for training, the communication, the respect, and the integrity of what we were doing to achieve our goal.
So I would agree, and I would completely agree about the Matildas. If people listen, if you're not familiar with the Matildas, they're the Australia football team. It's tricky with the word football in Australia. It seems to stand for about 10 sports. Being English, I know what football is. But it was true in the way that they showed up. I completely agree. There's still a way to go. And I think, you know, I would echo that is we're on the right path, but we need more people. We need more sporting organisations to focus on winning being the be-all and end-all, and winning being the prime product of a great culture that they actually take the time to build and support. Yeah.
And I think what I wanted to say before, obviously, it's not being able to buy into the process, you know, being clear about the process and what we need to do to achieve that end goal rather than, okay, that end goal, and that's all we're thinking about. And it's that's the process it. Yeah. And how we show up each day for each other, how we communicate. And I think in the sport of triathlon, it's come a long way and it's had its challenges. I found with my coach, Dan Atkins, who trains Olympian athletes and Paralympians, is that we just have this really great dynamic of, you know, I could talk to him about most things, and there was a real trust there because you're sharing so much with your coach. But also as a female athlete and as an athlete with a disability, I had the extra layers of fatigue. For me, commuting with a guide dog or a cane with, you know, profoundly deaf. And then as a woman athlete, and we have our own menstrual cycles and ups and downs with our hormones. And as a male coach, he had a lot to think about. And what I really liked and loved about Dan was he was open to all that. And we would have very open conversations. Where was I in the monthly cycle? How was my nutrition? You know, how was I coping with certain things that were happening in my personal life? So creating that real great culture, you know, it's because it's all in, right? So in triathlon, it's quite intense. But being able to have that real trust with your coach, in my instance, was absolutely critical.
Yeah, empathy and trust are the glue that holds high performance cultures together. I completely agree. Yes. Brian, my last question for you is, so what next, Katie? You're doing all this fabulous work. You're on the speaker circuit. You're sharing your stories. You've got the Sport Access Foundation. What's next?
Well, I guess I've got a few goals, but I think for me, the thing that drives me is am I doing enough in terms of, you know, giving back the privilege that I've had with the opportunities in my education, in my employment, and as a Paralympian athlete? So I sort of asked myself that question to drive, okay, and keeping myself in check of ensuring that I'm honestly advocating and doing what I need to do to improve lives of others who may not have the same voice that I have. And so that's kind of a key driver for me. But putting that aside, I'm really keen to, you know, opportunities to go overseas and to I guess build my craft to be an influential advocate for people with disability and in the inclusion space. And I'm thinking of, I never did that Hawaii Ironman, Colin, so it's at the back of my mind. I'm just, I don't know, I haven't done a triathlon since Tokyo, so I'm going to talk to my coach about it next week. We'll see.
If anyone can do it, Katie, you can definitely do it. Live that Hawaiian dream.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, Katie, it has been, I'm speaking for everybody listening, to say that it's been a pleasure to speak to you today. And thank you so much for sharing. I'm genuinely, you know, grateful for the fact that you've shared your, not only your backstory, your journey, but also what organizations need to think about. So thank you so much for joining me on the Culture Makers podcast today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the link with your colleagues and friends or with your connections on social media. If you'd like to find out more about the work that I do, head to www.colindellis.com or find me on LinkedIn.